around here. I got trapped downstairs.
In the Environment, yeah. Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Wednesday, March 20th, 2013, will come to order. We have a number of bonding bills on the agenda today, and I know Senator Stumpf is busy in Rules Committee right now. So is Senator Eakin, did I see you walk in somewhere? You walk out already.
There he is.
Stump. I don't see any root on here.
I guess so.
No wood?
For the record, a quorum is present.
I doubt it.
Senator Eakin, normally we let the senior member from the area go first, but you'll just have to figure that out with him later on, okay, if he comes in here while you're doing your bills. But my plan would be, as long as you're sitting at the table, we might as well do all three of your bills. So if you would like to just pick whichever one you want to do first, and let me know, and we'll just go ahead from there.
Sure. Let's see. Why don't we start off, Mr. Chair, with Senate File 296. And Mr. Chair and members, this is a bonding bill for completion of the flood projects in the Moorhead area. It asks for an appropriation of $14,700,000. And again, this is to complete the projects. There have been significant investments made in flood mitigation projects in the Moorhead area that have saved the state enormous amounts of money over time and have provided great relief, flood relief for the people in the Moorhead area. And as you know, and as many people in the state know, there's been significant problems in our area of the state due to the Red River, and because of the topography and because of the Red River, which flows to the north, this has created some real problems in our area. And we've been able to mitigate many of these problems. Again, this bonding appropriation would complete the projects in the Moorhead area and would complete all of the investments that have been made up till this point in time. I do have with me today the mayor of Moorhead, Mark Boxland, who is here to answer any questions that you may have and would also like to make a presentation on this request.
Welcome, Mayor. Just say your name for the record, and then you can go ahead and give your testimony.
Mark Voxland, Mayor of Moorhead.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing me this morning. I want to start out by telling you the flood forecast for the Red River of the North for this spring, there's a 50% chance that it'll go to 33.8 feet and a 5% chance it'll go to 38.2 feet. In 2009, the river went to 40.9 feet, which is the highest the Red River has gone in our recorded history of Moorhead. What we have done to date, I think, really shows the impact that the state and our local dollars have had protecting Moorhead. In 2009, we threw about 4 million sandbags to get to that 40.9 feet. When the river gets to 38.2 feet, in 2009 we would have needed to put down about 670,000 sandbags. This year we'll need to put down 33,000 sandbags. If the river were to go up to that 40-foot level, we'd need about 163,000 sandbags. So we have really come a long way. And what we've done with so far since the middle of 2009 to protect the city of Moorhead, we have bought out houses on a voluntary basis. We've bought out, get the number correct, 206, although we do have about 7 or 8 right now that are pending. We, again, those were all voluntary buyouts. We have put up 3.5 miles of diking. We have put in 7 miles of diking. We have put in 57 storm sewer gates, and we've put in 9 stormwater pump systems. What we've done basically is protected the city of Moorhead as best we can in as many places as we can from rise of the Red River. We've also protected ourselves so that we can have no water backing up through our storm sewer system. We put in gate valves so we can shut the Red River off so we can get police, fire, ambulance service through the streets. We don't have backwater coming up behind our dikes and flooding our streets. Because we do that, we also have to put in pumping systems so that if we get a rain event like we did in 1997 during a flood event, we can pump water from our streets back across the dikes. It gets to be kind of a crazy system that we have to deal with. We are almost at the point of finishing up our project. We have $14.7 million that we're going to ask for from the state. We'll still be using $1.5 million of our money. We've used about $18 million of our citizens' money to pair with the dollars that we've gotten from the state of Minnesota. Those dollars we got by special assessments and stormwater fees. What we've tried to do and what we're working on by getting this flood protection done is to literally protect the city as quickly as we can in case we have a fast flood. And we also want to not have to call out and use resources outside of the city of Moorhead. In 2009, we had a lot of National Guard presence. We also had presence from the National Guard in 2010 and 2011. Plus, we have to close colleges. We have to ask colleges from around the state to come and help us sandbag. We are to the point where we're almost out of that need. And so by getting these last dollars, we feel we can we will close this project out and we'll have Moorhead protected to 42.5 feet, which is what the Corps of Engineers says is the 100-year high water mark. Do you have any questions? Glad to try to answer.
What's the 500-year mark?
The 500-year mark is 45.6 feet. There isn't a lot of difference between the 100 and the 500 because, quite honestly, the Red River Valley around Moorhead is about as flat as that table.
Just for out of curiosity, these three pictures here, is that the progression or what is?
Let's see. It's on the. I don't have that particular hand. Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay.
Those show some different projects that have been built. The top one is a levee that's being built in South Moorhead. The middle one, that's a levee that's completed. And the bottom one shows a concrete wall that we've built in areas where we don't have a lot of room and we have some unstable soils. We can put in flood walls. So that's what those three show.
Do those open up or are they permanent?
Those are permanent. Where they cross the street, we have an aluminum gate system that we can put in place.
Mayor, I'm just out of curiosity. I don't know if I've seen this language on Section C here. What's the median income of a household in Moorhead? Do we know that or?
I don't dare answer that. I don't recall right off hand.
Okay.
It changed during the last census. It used to be 32,000 was our median income.
Okay. All right. I think it's pretty standard language for these flood bills, right? Mr. Lockesmoke can tell us how that works exactly.
Mr. Chairman, Kent Lockesmoke, Director of Capital Investment for DNR. For the city of Moorhead, we do calculate the 2% median household income after each census. These are 2010 numbers. And so the number changed a little bit for Moorhead. And based on that census, the median household, and this is information from the state's demographer's office. The median household income is $43,402, resulting in a 2% median household income match for the city of $12,416,000. And that jumped up substantially from the 2000 census. Initially, their cost share was about $8.5 million, so it increased by $4 million. And the city has met that, and as the mayor said, has actually more than met that.
Okay. Any questions of Senator Engelbrecht?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hailing from the Red River Valley myself and part of my district being in it now, Mayor, could you comment on as to the amount of work that's been done with regards to ponding, holding back water, whether you think it's doing any good? And the second question I would have is, what's Fargo doing? Are they partnering with you? Are they?
As far as ponding and you're talking upstream mm-hmm. storage. We have the Red River Basin group, and they're here. Buffalo group is part of that, and they're here today. The Red River watershed area has been doing some ponding, putting in some dry dikes, trying to keep some water back, and there is a lot of plans on the table to do that. The problem gets to be to drop a foot and a half of height on the Red River going through Fargo-Moorhead. You have to impound about, I believe the number was 400,000 acre feet, and that gets to be a pretty big number, again, to try to do it on an area that's pretty flat. You can't store water at a real high level when it's as flat as it is in most of the valley, and in areas where it will affect you in Fargo-Moorhead. As far as what Fargo's doing, we each have to fight our own battle, not only during the flood fight, but for flood mitigation work. And that's because we have two different types of systems in place for our sewer and stormwater, and we have different elevations. We, in Moorhead, state of Minnesota, we're great because we're about 4 feet higher than Fargo and North Dakota. And why that happens in this area, I don't know. But I certainly am glad I'm on this side of the river as far as flooding is concerned. Fargo has put a half-cent sales tax on their citizens, and the county has put a half-cent sales tax on their citizens. Most of the money right now is going to buy out homes along the Red River, and they're starting to do a dike system. When FEMA came out with their revised 100-year flood plan, map last year, the city of Fargo ended up having about 2,300 structures added to the map, so they need flood insurance, mostly south of the interstate. Moorhead had 16. I say these numbers just to show you the huge dilemma that the city of Fargo has when it comes to flooding. What they've done so far is pretty minimal compared to what they need to do, but they have started to try to catch up to what we've been trying to do in Moorhead since 2009.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Mayor, and knowing that, you know, we do all this work on our side of the river. That's going to put the water someplace else. We all know that. So I appreciate that answer. I appreciate the work that's going on. I also would say 4 feet in that particular area is eligible for a ski lodge, I think. 4 feet different. I didn't realize it was quite so high.
So, and Mayor, do you have an idea of how much federal money is involved here? I mean, it's got to be a big, big number, I would think.
Federal money for our particular mitigation program is almost none.
Oh, really?
We really haven't tried to do that route. The way the federal government has worked and the type of programs they have just really wouldn't work for us. We started in 2009, literally 2 days after the Crest. We were down here in St. Paul talking with you folks in the Senate and the House, trying to figure out a way that we could stop this ridiculousness of going through flood after flood. And literally, our community comes to a standstill for 2 to 6 weeks while we fight this. So
I can believe it. And so this would be this appropriation here should get it all done?
This would get it all done.
Okay. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was my question. I was running out of the $35 million. How many is purchase of homes? Is that the 46? Or
46 homes are left to be bought out, yes.
Okay.
We have gone through, to give you an idea, we've gone through and we've asked everybody this first time, and we've got the first 206 homes. The last 46, we're going back and asking again. We've got a lot more interest. Since the river's going up this year, people are interested in maybe getting away from the river. Last year, we had no flood and nobody was interested.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. And maybe I was out of the room and I apologize, Mayor, but or Senator, maybe you can answer this. The ground saturation from last fall, are we expecting a pretty good flood, or have we got some dryness in our subsoil that's going to absorb some of this most recent white stuff that we've all been blessed with in western Minnesota?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it is very dry. I mean, there's not much subsoil moisture. We had a dry year last year. It wasn't too terribly bad for the farmers because the rains came just at the right times. Mm-hmm. But There's not much subsoil moisture there. So there is some capacity there. The problem is, of course, that the ground is pretty well frozen, and when the snow melt occurs, the water runs off. And so I do have some concerns about the lateness of the spring, and if everything goes all at once, that could pose some problems as far as flooding. But I do think that we're not in as bad a shape as we've been in other years when we've had even more significant snowpacks. And the mayor may be able to answer more specifically.
Oh, that's fine. I think I understand.
You got it.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no further questions, we'll lay Senate File 296 over for possible inclusion in the recommendation to the bonding committee. Senator Eakin, which one do you want to do next?
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill, should this be moved then to, or is are
well,
these?
Well, we're going to lay 296 over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee, and then we'll go on to your next bill then.
Sure. We can go to Senate File number 751. And this bill is also a bonding project for flood mitigation, and it's for the Oakport Township, which is just north of Moorhead. As a matter of fact, in 2015, it will be a part of Moorhead. Moorhead is in the process of annexing the Oakport Township. And they, too, have had significant investments made in flood mitigation over the years since the major flood in 97 was when they first started designing this project. And it's an area that, like Moorhead, has had a long history of flooding problems caused by the Red River of the North. And the damages have cost in the millions, in terms of the hours and emergency preparation, damages to public infrastructure, such as the roads and bridges, the sewer, water utilities, the costs in relocation and evacuation, the post-flood cleanup costs, the social costs, and and most of the projects have been completed in the Oakport Township flood mitigation policy or process here as well. And we're looking for an additional funding of $5,620,000 that would complete everything in the Oakport Township flood mitigation process here. So, again, this would be to complete the project. Already been major investments made in this area. And so we're just asking to finish the job. This would protect approximately 750 acres and 700 residents. This is an area that is going to be annexed into Moorhead, and I think that the folks in the area want to make sure that it's completed before the annexation occurs, that we get this flood mitigation project done as well. So, and I do have with me today Bruce Albright, who is the manager of the Buffalo Red River Watershed, to speak to it more.
Okay. And may you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Greg Anderson, and I'll go ahead. On behalf of the residents of Oakport Township and the Buffalo Red River Watershed, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. With me again is Bruce Albright, the manager of the Buffalo Red River Watershed District. I was the chairman of the township board from 2002 until 2011, and I continue to serve on the planning and technical committee to get this dike completed. A little bit of background, Oakport Township is an urban township directly north of the city of Moorhead. The Red River flows through Moorhead and comes to the south side of Oakport, and then it cuts west, and it parallels Oakport for about a mile and a half before it proceeds north. So we get a lot of water coming through Fargo-Moorhead that come up into Oakport Township. 1997 was probably what we thought would be the worst flood we'd ever see, and that flood was 38.5 feet. At that time, it impacted about 500 homes. Many of them were severely damaged. We lost sewer service. A lot of homes were flooded by backed-up sewer systems during that flood. At the end of that flood, the township approached the United States Army Corps of Engineers and requested that they do a 205 study to review and determine if we had a project there. The Corps did work with us for 6 years. They studied it. They determined a project was in order. It didn't meet the federal guidelines, and they recommended that we take it on as a local project. So at that point, once the Corps turned us down for the project, the township approached the Buffalo Red River Watershed District and asked them to be the project sponsor. One of the challenges we have being a township, in essence, we're serving about 2,000 people, And our entire staff consists of five elected officials. We have no paid city staff or township staff. So in essence, those folks rely on the ability of five volunteers to run a township for them. And that's why we had to go to the Watershed District for support. We needed professional help. The Watershed District did bring forth a project, and we brought that here to the state and partnered with the state to get that project underway. Design and the geotechnical work started in 2005. Before we could get anything on the ground, we got hit with the 2009 flood, which, as the mayor indicated, instead of 38.5, we were almost 41 feet. We saw devastation that we couldn't imagine up there. To give you an example, in less than 10 days, the township of Oakport, relying on the generosity of people from 200 miles away coming in to help us, we filled 1.5 million sandbags strictly with volunteer help in less than 10 days. In addition to that, we built about 20 or 30 earthen levees around homes and neighborhoods. With that, we were somewhat successful, but we still lost hundreds of homes to flooding. Also during that time, again, the sewer service was interrupted. We get our sewer and our water supply from the city of Moorhead. That's why we have an annexation agreement. And at one point during the flood, even the drinking water system appeared to be at risk, and we actually lost potable drinking water for a couple days. The city had to disconnect us, and we understand why. They didn't want to lose it for the entire city. It got to be very challenging, and it was really difficult having a plan and having everything drawn out and nothing in place to help those people in 2009. Since 2009, we've started building dikes, and we've got about 5.5 miles of those dikes constructed. We have all of the land acquired, we have all of the plans in place, and we have been building as fast as we can acquire funding to get the work done. In 2011, another flood came along that we thought would be similar to the 2009 flood. And to show you the difference we've made up to 2011, we went from 1.5 million sandbags in 2009 to less than 10,000 in 2011. The Corps was able to build temporary dikes in the unfinished areas, and we were able to do a pretty good job to protect the township in 2011. There was very little, if any, damage. We required very little outside help. Where we stand now is we need this last $5.6 million to finish this project. It's been nice to come down here and work with you folks to get this done, but I'd rather come down here and just sit in the audience and watch rather than sit at this table and ask for help. The project is ready. The land is acquired. The plans are done. If we can get the funding, we can actually start moving dirt, and we could hopefully get this finished yet in 2013. Unfortunately, we might be fighting a flood in 2013. Again, it won't be so bad, but we'd really like to get it done this year and have everything behind us. One of the things I didn't mention, and I should back up to it, a big part of our project ended up being about 60 buyouts. When we started this, we didn't realize how many homes were going to be in areas that either couldn't be protected or would fall underneath the footprint of the dike. As we did the geotechnical work and we found the issues with unstable soil along the river, we determined that we had to make the dike a little bit bigger, a little bit wider, or move it further back from the river. A second important thing that we had to look at was that we would have no impact on anybody else. It didn't do us or anyone any good if we built a levee that would cause flooding issues to Moorhead or to Fargo or to other homes in Oakport. And so we had to design a footprint and acquire more homes to make sure that we cause no harm upon our neighbors. An earlier question related to storage, another critical component of our dike are several stormwater ponds that are built inside the dike. If my memory is correct, I believe we can handle about 8 to 10 inches of rain and store that water inside a dike during a flood so we don't have an impact on our neighbors. The whole goal is to complete this to protect people, to not require resources from other flood fights, and to not do damage to anybody else. And I thank you for that, and I know Mr. Albright has things sure. He wishes to comment on.
Before we pass on to Ms. Albright, any question or discussion from the committee? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple of questions. Mr. Anderson, thank you for the testimony. And you said there was 60 buyouts. How old are the homes on these buyouts that you're talking about? That'd be my first question, and I'll follow up with another one if I might, Mr. Chair.
I'm trying to picture them going by neighborhood. I want to be accurate. A lot of the homes in Oakport, the development started in this area back probably in the early 1950s, late 1940s. Many of the homes we acquired on Broadway would have been built in the 40s, 50s, early 60s. Some of the homes in the Wall Street area, I think, might have been built in the 70s. I don't think we've purchased any homes that were built after about 1975 that come to mind.
Thank you. And just to follow up with regards to the Army Corps of Engineers members, one should wonder why things move in a snail's pace when it comes to the Army Corps. I don't know if they're here or not to make any comments, and I don't want to beat them up because they're not here. But 6-year study and nothing at the end of that. I guess what I'm wondering is if during that 6-year period, if the federal government got involved at all in that, other than the Corps, did they come up with any funding at all? I know you say you like to come down here and be a witness and not an asker, and I certainly understand why you're asking. Is it because the federal government's not willing to help out?
They have provided no funding that I'm aware of during my term from 2002 to 2011, and I don't believe they did anything before then. I know we invested, I'm guessing, and Bruce, you may recall, probably $200,000 to $300,000 that we invested into the 205 study. By the same token, the Corps has been our savior when they've come up to build the emergency levees, the folks that are the boots on the ground that show up to help you. They're second to none, and they're excellent at helping you tear the dikes down. Our goal is just to not need that assistance. We'd rather just be done with it and not squander money building a dike just to tear it down 2 weeks later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with that.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have visited this area on a capital investment tour, and I sort of have an understanding of what you're doing there. And that was a pretty nice neighborhood. Some of those 70s houses were quite nice. Does any of this $5.6 million go toward buying any more of those homes, or have they all been purchased at this time?
Everything has been acquired. We're strictly at a build mode, and we're shovel ready to go.
I also have a question as well, Mr. Anderson. I look at the map from the bird eyes view, and it seems like it's in a floodplain. And you know, I hear you mention about number of flood incidents in the past. Is it a good idea to expand on this part of the city?
I think the goal is not to expand outside of the protected areas, and although a lot of it appears that it may be in a floodplain, a majority of it's not actually in the floodplain. The river flows through the lower areas, but we've protected those very well.
Okay. Thank you. Any other question from community members? Then we'll go on to Mr. Bruce Albright. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Bruce Albright, Administrator, Buffalo Red River Watershed District. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for hearing us yet again on Oakport. I guess reiterate a lot, or I won't go over what the mayor and Mr. Anderson has already said. We've been at this now for 15 years, and we would just like to get Oakport done. We have the final phase left, estimated to cost $5.6 million to do that. The people of Oakport have held up their end of the bargain with the 2% medium household income. We've been at this for so long that we started out with the 1990 census, which they had to come up with $300,000. Then the 2000 census, their amount was increased to $500,000. And now with the 2010 census, they're up to $750,000. So they've kept their end of the deal. We would just like to get done. As Mr. Anderson indicated, we're shovel ready, plans and specs ready to go. With yet the threat of another flood looming on us here this spring, we just hate to put up temporary dikes. That's expensive. To take down those temporary dikes costs more money. We don't fully protect the infrastructure, the sewer and the water, until the final phase of the project is done. And have three senators on the committee who all represent constituents in the Buffalo Red River Watershed District, Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senator Scoey, and Senator Westrum. So they are familiar with the area. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Okay. Any question from committee members? Okay. With that, yes, Senator Westrum.
Mr. Albright, we hear a lot of the discussion about the diversion, whether diversion would go around Fargo or Moorhead. Any update on where that is at, and more related to this issue, if that would go in, and let's say it would go the Fargo side, would that change what is needed here?
Senator Westrum, yes, it would. The diversion, which would go on the Fargo side, would provide protection for the Oakport area. The reason why we made a decision to go ahead with this in 2009 was the uncertainty involving the diversion. While a lot of the studies have been done for that project, it needs to be named in Washington on a public works bill or a WERDA bill. When that might happen might be a year or so down the road. That would only make it eligible for federal assistance, and so no money on the federal end has been promised for that almost $2 billion project. So it's got a long ways to go to get the federal funding to make that happen.
And it may never happen.
Yeah, you are correct, sir.
And
very good.
Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, and if it does happen, it's still many years down the road before such a project could be constructed and completed, and this would provide more immediate relief in those intervening years. And again, the investments have already been made in the majority of this project. This is just the last final piece of it to complete it.
Mr. Anderson, you have comments?
And one of the things, that Bruce, maybe you can help me with this, but as I understood it, the idea behind the diversion and my early participation in those meetings, it would pull the Red River down by about 8 or 9 feet on the south end of Fargo-Moorhead, but the benefit to the north end was considerably less. And Bruce, do you recall, I was thinking they said it may lower the water by 3 to 4 feet in Oakport, but it still wouldn't have the benefit you would see to the south. So even with the diversion, we would still have some issues to protect.
Okay, we shall. Yep, we shall lay over Senate 751 to for recommendation to this to the Capital Investment Committee for inclusion in an omnibus bonding bill. Thank you, Senator Atkin.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Next, we have Senator Stumpf.
One more Eakin
bill. Sorry, Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chair, okay. Thank you.
It's on the other side of the page.
And that would be Senate File 355.
Yes.
And this project doesn't deal with flooding. So this one deals with the construction of a material recovery facility and a new transfer station in Becker County. There's two issues that have been hot topics here in the legislative agenda, including environmental issues and human services. And this, Becker County has come up with an innovative solution here to combine these two disciplines. They propose using the sentence to serve program and also to enable individuals with disabilities that are identified as having disabilities by the Health and Human Services Department in various recycling and reuse programs. And again, it's two pieces here. The first part is to construct a material recovery facility to process recyclable materials, replacing a processing facility they currently have, which is terribly inadequate and can't meet the needs, which have been growing in Becker County. Also, in the second part is to construct a new transfer station to meet the state solid waste facility rules, replacing a 25-year-old facility that is obsolete by state standards. And these new facilities would allow the county to efficiently collect, process, and market recyclable and solid waste materials while training and employing underserved populations. And I do have with me today Mr. Steve Skoog, who is the director of the Becker County Environmental Services, to testify as well on the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Skoog. Can you please state your name for the record?
Steve Skoog. I'm the director of Becker County Environmental Services for Becker County.
You may proceed.
Thank you for allowing me to testify. Our project, or this bill, is really two projects, and I'm going to take these in reverse order. The first part is a transfer station. Several years ago, the state helped fund the purchase and expansion of the Perm Incinerator in Perm, Minnesota, which Becker County joined together with three other counties to purchase and expand that. And that project is in the works right now. They've already let out bids on that. That's about a $30 million project. And as part of that project, the state allows counties, if you're improving the way that you're handling waste, they'll help pay for some of the infrastructure to make that project happen. And we do need a new transfer station. Our existing one is too small. And with an incinerator, you have to be able to separate some of the waste prior to sending it to the incinerator. You have to help clean it up. And so we do need a larger transfer station that will allow us to do that. So that's the first part of this. The other part is with our recycling program. Over the last number of years, we've been changing that up, and the county took a more active role in our recycling program when we changed how we're collecting it on the rural areas. And the county invested about between $500,000 and $750,000, depending on how you count it. But we changed up from using, we got about 45 collection sites around the county, which we switched from using sheds and barrels. And in our pamphlet, there's some pictures of it. And we designed some special recycling containers and purchased a truck and hired some staff to man the truck. And as a result, our recycling rate went from, it increased about 40% the first year from 2011 to 2012. And we don't have a facility really adequate to handle those types of changes. And so we're looking for some funding to help build a recycling facility that will allow us to do that. What we were hoping to do is to build a facility that's designed that you can use sentenced to serve and or people with disabilities to help process those recyclables, and then the sale of those commodities will help fund those jobs. Of course, the facility would keep those two separate. So that's really what we're looking for.
Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Scoot. Any comments or questions from the committee? Any other testifiers? Yeah. Welcome, Kirk. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Adelko with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We just wanted to put in a quick word of support for this facility. It really is needed to help with the solid waste goals we have in the state. As mentioned earlier, it would help with the recycling rates in this part of the area, and it also benefits other counties, as explained with the waste energy facility. A number of facilities outside the metropolitan area are aging, and there are other facilities around the state that could benefit from improved facilities to help with the state's solid waste goals, including increased recycling and others.
That sounds good. Good support. Any comment from committee members? Okay. With that, we will lay over this set of 5355 for recommendation to capital investment for inclusion in the omnibus bonding bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Scoot. Next is Senator Stump. Senator Stump, Senate File 676.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the time this afternoon. We have three proposals. Senate File 676 is the flood hazardous mitigation grants, and this is one that has been before the legislature for quite some time. It has been developed over the years as a very helpful program in trying to reduce flooding in many communities around the state. One of the benefits of this program is that it's flexible enough that when we put bonding money into this program, And there's a long list of different communities that can that have requested help, that money can be worked around so that as one community is ready, it can be funded. And as the next community gets ready, that can be funded. And so the money is used very efficiently. And as you see in the clause C there, there's a large number of communities, cities around the state that have been put into this proposed legislation. And as other communities are in need, those communities get added to that list and can also receive help. The appropriation request for bonding is $35 million. And then as we lay out the needs, both Mr. Lacosmo from the Department of Natural Resources and Mr. Harnack, who works with the Red River Water Management District, can lay out the more details, the exact amount that where those dollars will be directed. So maybe it would be best if we'd have Mr. Lacosmo maybe go through this and.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Lacosmo. Please state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm Kent Lacosmo. I'm the Director of Capital Investment for DNR. And within your packets, members, there is a copy of the PowerPoint presentation that just gives an overview of the program. This program has existed since, late 1980s. It's been very effective. It's certainly got a big boost in funding since 1997 and the numerous floods that have happened since then. It's a mature program. We've been very effective in getting projects done. I think we've completed 285 projects across the state. You'll see a map in this handout that kind of shows the distribution of projects. Certainly the Red River has gotten a lot of attention in the recent years because of major floods in the last many major floods in the last decade. The other thing that's in your packet, and because I don't need to go over that PowerPoint in detail, is this colored chart that shows all of the projects that we're aware of. This isn't all the projects that could be funded by even the $35 million if that were to be appropriated. But what this shows in green, and it's broken into three parts. The first area on the top is the federal projects. Next are the local community projects. And on the bottom are the Red River Watershed District projects. And the items shown in green are projects that are completed or will be completed with existing funding. And these are just the projects since 2008. And I'm sure many of you recall in the last two sessions, we got $80 million appropriated to this program, and we have about $2 million left. We're very effective at spending the money because of the flexibility that has been provided by the legislature in the program, as Senator Stumpf said. So what this this list shows is all of the projects that we know about, what the total estimated project cost is, what kind of project it is, whether it's levees, pump stations, acquisitions. Then the other column is what we have committed out of the existing funds that we have from 2011 and 12. And then the final column is the remaining state dollars needed. One word of caution with this list is it's ever-changing. And just like in the paragraph C on the bill, there are communities listed on there that we think will be completed with the existing funding. But we would recommend that those cities remain listed because something may happen, the cost may go up, and by having them listed in the bill, they're eligible for the 2% cost share funding. So because we believe Breckenridge and Granite Falls will be completed with existing funding, but something still could change on those numbers. I mean, just this week, we heard that Granite Falls got $1.5 million in a federal grant, so that reduced our cost by $1.5 million, but the numbers still could change a little bit. So we try to leverage as much federal money as we can in this program, and there are the two, but that's fraught with problems, as you've heard from previous programs, or previous bills that were testified today. So that the final column for remaining dollars needed totals $101 million. Those aren't all projects that are ready to be built in 2013, but and as I said, we manage the money to give it to those that can spend the money the quickest, and we've been successful with that. If there's any questions from the members, I'd stand for them.
Yes, Mr. Lacimo, I see Moorhead is listed here as well as Oakport Township. Is that going to be double the amount since they're remaking the request for themselves as well?
Mr. Chairman, this list represents all of the known projects, and it's like for Moorhead, it's 14.7 is what was in their bill that you just heard, mm-hmm. and Oakport Township, the 5.6 million is in the bill that you just heard. So it doesn't double count; it's just reflecting all of the projects that we are aware of.
And Senator Scully.
Thank you. And Mr. Lacismo, it's a good list, very helpful. But I'm curious about Oslo. All the other project descriptions are acquisition or levy or something, but Oslo just says Oslo. I was wondering what's going on there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scully, the Oslo project is a rebuilding of their existing levee system. Their levee system was built by the Corps of Engineers, 30 years ago, I think, for a cost of $3 million. That project has actually ended up having benefits of over $60 million in averted damages over the years. And as you know, Senator Scoy, the soils along the river are very poor, and that results in the levees needing to be set back further, and that's part of the project in Oslo. So it is bringing their levees up to current standards and setting them back further from the river. And they are partially done. They would need, as we indicate here, $2 million to finish their project.
Senator Scully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lacismo. I spent part of the 97 flood up helping in Oslo, so I'm familiar with it. Are they bringing their some of their ponds into the levee system then, or is that still outside?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, do you mean their sewage treatment ponds? Those would all be within the levee system.
Okay, thank you.
Any discussion from community members? Okay. Mr. Harnack, can you please state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ron Harnack. I'm project coordinator for the Red River Watershed Management Board. And what I'd like to add to in terms of what Kent has already provided is the Red River Watershed Management Board is a joint powers of watershed districts in the Red River Valley. And we have a unique financial capacity to work with individual watershed districts to help leverage state and local dollars towards implementation of projects. The primary focus of the Red River Watershed Management Board is to meet some broad goals that have been established for the Red River Basin as a whole, to reduce main stem peak flows from north to south by 20%, and to do that through distributed floodwater retention within each one of the major watershed districts. The benefit of that is it provides significant local benefit. Many of our projects, once completed, virtually eliminate any kind of damages to rural road infrastructure, minimizes the damages to agricultural activities, as well as providing for the added agricultural productivity by providing adequate outlets for drainage that takes place within the Red River Valley before. You have before you a document that looks like this. Within that, this is the Red River Watershed Management Board's bonding, general fund, and clean water legacy funding proposals. So,
That's the FY 2014 15 legislative briefing.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And if you went to page 3, and I apologize for not having them numbered, the list that you see there is the list that we are promoting for funding in this bonding cycle. We have two communities, the communities of Climax and Neillsville. The $4 million will complete the ring dikes for those two communities and provide them proper protection. We also have Bear Park Project that's still in the process. We're not proposing any money for it this year, but if this were to be a two-year bonding bill, there would be requests for next year. Bois de Sioux is a North Ottawa project. The major construction on that is already complete. As part of that project, we are dividing the pools so that we can enhance natural resources components to it, particularly as it relates to waterfowl production and migration. The Red Path project is a new project. We have the land acquired in it. We're ready to move to construction. That would provide 22,000 acre-feet of storage, not only having significant benefit downstream immediately, but also benefits as far downstream as Breckenridge and Fargo-Moorhead by increasing their degree of protection above and beyond what they would normally have just with their levee system. One other project that I want to just highlight, showing the cooperation between the state and the districts, is the Roseau River Wildlife Management Area, in which there was significant damage to their outlet control at a, forget which flood it was now, but what we're proposing there is to help rebuild that, modify the structures so that we can not only optimize the flood storage on that facility, but also significantly enhance the wildlife and waterfowl management for that particular pool. So the Red River Watershed Management Board matches federal or state funding. The way we typically do it, if we have a project that is 50-50 between state and local, Kent's program through the Flood Damage Reduction Program provides 50%. The Red River Watershed Management Board provides 2/3 of the remaining cost, and the local watershed district provides the last 1/3 cost as part of it. So we are also hoping, depending on how the federal government proceeds with the federal farm bill, on both the Senate and House side, there is significant dollars in it for river basin authorities in the United States. And the Red River Watershed Management Board and the Minnesota and the Red River Retention Authority is one of five that would have access to up to $100 million a year for floodwater retention. We'll wait and see how Congress deals with the federal farm bill, but if that does pass, we are hopeful of receiving maybe $20 to $25 million out of that pot towards floodwater retention projects in the Red River Valley. All our retention projects are multi-purpose. We have significant water quality benefits. In some cases, by virtue of our projects, we are able to eliminate the impairments due to sediment, which is the major impairment in the Red River Valley. In addition, it's the habitat components, in addition to flood control, that's provided for the Red River Basin and downstream communities. So, Mr. Chairman, there are additional sheets on each one of the projects that we're proposing. I don't intend to go through those, but if anybody has any questions on any specific project, I'd be happy to try and answer those questions.
Okay. Any question from community members? No question from community member. We will lay Senate file 676 for recommendation to Capital Investment Committee for inclusion in the omnibus bonding bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Lacimo and Mr. Hartnett. Senator Stumpf, Senate File 833.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senate File 833, and this is a good follow-up, I think, on the last bill. This is a project that has incorporated a lot of different groups and organizations and communities to try to clean up the Red River, and it actually has gone beyond the Red River and its tributaries through a process of using secondary students, professionals, community experts, and a broad range of others in monitoring and testing the water for purposes of cleaning it up. And we have Mr. Charles Fritz, who is very knowledgeable about this program, and I'd like to have him kind of give the explanation. We were hoping that we would have a group of students that are participants in this group or this project, but because they had designated this day as their gathering together and sharing information, they're all not able to come down. So maybe we can have Mr. Fritz.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Fritz. Please state your full name for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Fritz. I'm the director of the International Water Institute, and I would refer you to the document that Mr. Harnack referenced, the last two pages, provide you information on the Riverwatch program. A little background on my organization, the International Water Institute was formed after the 1997 flood, and I'm responsible for doing two things in the Red River Basin: watershed research and watershed education. And the signature program that we administer and operate is the Riverwatch program. And it's a program that was actually started in 1995 in the Sandhill watershed with a pilot in four schools. This year we'll be serving 29 schools, and it will be 30 by the end of this summer throughout the Red River Basin. And you can see a map on the last page that kind of indicates where those schools are. It's watershed education, and it provides a number of outdoor activities designed to their outdoor experiences that are provided in a context of watershed education. And Senate Bill 833, I'm here to support that bill, would help us to leverage the local commitment to that program. There is a financial commitment, of course, locally. The Red River Watershed Management Board does provide $100,000 of local money to that program, but I also should mention that the program itself is successful because of partnerships. State, local, and federal partnerships, and we have countless hours of in-kind dollars. And Senator Stumpf mentioned today is the annual forum, the signature event for the program. It's the 18th year of the Riverwatch Forum. It's held in the University of Minnesota Crookston. It's 300 kids and teachers get together, and this is the first time in 18 years that I've missed it. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fritz, and please give the student our regards as well.
I will.
So any question from committee? Committee members? Okay. Then we will lay over Senate File 833 for recommendation to the Legacy Subcommittee inclusion in the Clean Water Fund.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Senator Stumpf, Senate File 850.
Mr. Chairman and members, the last proposal is actually a result of the flood of 1997, and that was the flood that was in the Red River Valley, and one of the areas that was heavily damaged with that flood was the Grand Forks, East Grand Forks communities, and one portion of East Grand Forks. As you come in on Highway U.S. Highway 2, there's an area that I think it was about approximately 400 and
roughly that, yes.
Roughly about over 400 homes that was totally inundated, flooded. And so all of those homes have disappeared. They had to be torn down, removed. And that area right now is a state recreation area. It's the Red River State Recreation Area. And so a campground was set up there, and it has prospered immensely. I think at least twice it has been expanded. And what this proposal is asking for is some additional expansion of camping places. Many of those places were that had homes that had driveways going into their garages and stuff. So the infrastructure, I believe, I'm not sure if they use the exact same infrastructure for sewer, but this whole area now is a campground, and a lot of people from the surrounding area to the Grand Forks, East Grand Forks area, and a lot of Canadian visitors come down and use the campground. So if maybe you want to add something to it.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Huizenga. I'm the city administrator for East Grand Forks. And Senator Stump summed up the history pretty well. The Red River State Recreational Area as a whole encompasses over 1,000 acres in East Grand Forks that basically go along the Red River and the Red Lake River that meet in East Grand Forks. And it's the greenway system that is part of our flood protection project that came after the flood of 1997. That was designated by legislation in 2000, I believe, as the Red River State Recreational Area. And we've had, a flourishing partnership since that time. As Senator Stump said, in the center of the recreational area is a campground that has over 100 sites, of which about 65 or so right now have full-service utilities. And that's important to this campground because the large majority of our traffic comes from recreational vehicle traffic. A lot of that traffic comes over half from Canadian visitors as well as other outstate visitors. So virtually all of the money that we get down there is what you might call new money to the local and state economies. So it's a very important economic driver for us as well as a very scenic, picturesque area of the community full of recreational opportunities, walkways, bike ped paths, et cetera. What we are requesting for in the Senate file is an appropriation of $250,000 to fully expand the campground to utilize its full potential for the type of visitors that we get. The city greatly values the partnerships it's had with the state and the DNR over the years. In 2009, the city invested over $400,000 of strictly local funds to provide the first expansion for this campground, which at the time was 15 sites. At that time, we had to lay in the mains as well, so it was a more costly endeavor. We also, in 2010 and 2011, with authority from the state to use local tax increment financing, we invested another approximately $50,000 in a playground in the area. Again, local funds, so it goes to show that the city is very committed to this campground and the entire rec area for the long haul. We value the partnership greatly. We can show, and I'm not sure what you have in your packet today, Mr. Chairman, but I can show some of the financials in the past that shows that 2012 was a record year for the facility. It actually generates what you might call a profit that goes to both the state and the city. And again, it's a very, very valuable partnership that we have, and we hope that continues for a long time. And we appreciate you listening today, and I'll answer any questions you might have. Any question from committee members? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator and Mr. Huizenga, talk to me about the profit. I was going to ask the question. You certainly charge fees there, do you? And the other question I would have is, have you sought any, and I see this is bonding money, have you sought any money from the rural parks legacy funding?
Oh, was the legacy part? I'm sorry, Senator.
Have you sought money from the legacy funding in the past for expansion in the park? And you do charge fees, apparently, because you do have some obviously.
Well, revenue. We do through the state. It is a state recreational area, so it goes off of the fee schedule through the DNR. But we administer it on behalf of the state, yes.
We have not specifically for this project, no. We have applied in the past for legacy funds in conjunction with some walkway bike ped improvements. There one in which we were successful that's outside the campground. We made some walkway improvements last year. But, no, we have not specifically sought or been granted legacy funds for campground expansion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just the basic question just crosses my mind. Who are you competing with, and is there private campgrounds out there that, I mean, in essence, if we share or provide some bonding money for you and the city to do this, what kind of competition are you to private businesses out there trying to do the same thing?
Senator, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I can fully answer your question. What I can tell you is that in East Grand Forks, we regard the campground as essentially our hotel. So there are a few in the area. The nearest campground, at least on the Minnesota side, I have to think is at least 30, 40 miles away. I'm not sure, Senator, you may have a better idea than I do of that, but it is the only facility within several miles available for this type of traffic. And
refresh me, I might have missed it. How many do you have now? 15, did you say, and you're looking to grow how many?
Total sites?
Yeah.
We have over 100 total sites, of which about 65, I believe, have utilities already, and we're looking to grow by 25, basically convert 25 of the sites that do not have utilities into fully serviced sites.
Okay. And what's the amount your city is contributing?
This one is an expansion of the past. The first project that we did, and that was $400,000.
Okay. Very good. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Scowie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Stumpford, to the testifier, how does that work, being that you're a state park or a state recreation area? How does the city end up contributing to these state parks and state recreation areas? I'm curious of the mechanism for that.
For Senator, Mr. Chair, for the past projects, it was simply a joint powers agreement at the time. Some of the committee may or may not know that we have a unique arrangement with the DNR compared to some of the other activities. Like, again, the city actually operates the park on behalf of the state, and we essentially have a mechanism for a revenue sharing agreement in which the city reimburses the state for its overhead and other administrative support that provides, and then the remaining balance is distributed between the city and the state. At the time, we did not have that agreement, but the city essentially volunteered to make the first investment of capital into that project in 2009, just because we feel that strongly about what an important service it is for our area.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, the reason I asked the question, members, is so you understood that this truly is a state park that has a joint operating agreement with the city, which is pretty efficient way to provide that kind of services for the people. And for those of you who've been up in the Red River Valley, that part of the area, there just aren't a lot of other camping opportunities until you get quite a ways east over toward the more forested part of the state. So it's a pretty good project they got going on there.
Thank you, Senator
Scowie. Mr. Chairman, I might add to what Senator Scowie mentioned. After the flood of 97, almost the entire city was flooded. But the right downtown area rebuilt, and we don't have a lot of manufacturing in East Grand Forks, so a lot of the rebuilding ended up, they have quite a few restaurants and a relatively large movie theater with I'm not sure how many different areas, and so the campground actually brings in quite a few people to the community. And visiting with some of them last year, one of the things that you wouldn't think of campers doing is that people come to camp in East Grand Forks, stay in their campers, and then go over to Grand Forks, where the larger medical facility is, the All True medical facility for their chemotherapy. And so they use it not just for camping, but for healthcare. A lot of them do anyway.
Interesting.
And so it's been a kind of a gradually evolving campgrounds that has been quite successful.
Good. Thank you, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, and to Senator Scoy's comments. Is this actually then one of our state parks? I mean, is that would it be considered that?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, yes, it is. It's called a state recreation area.
Okay.
But it's a state park. They have you get in with the state, the state park sticker, the same way as you would as any other campground, state park
okay.
campground.
Thank you, Senator Scoy, for asking that question because that helps clarify the partnership and a unique arrangement. So,
and Senator Stumpf, you're making very enticing. Maybe I'd take a visit there this summer.
I would, Mr. Chairman, welcome you up, and I'd be happy to go over there and show you the nice community and park.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, just if I could follow up, this is daily camping, but is there also like seasonals that just park there?
Not continuously. It's similar to most campgrounds. I think there is a maximum, and I believe 7 days at a time is about the maximum. But you can purchase annual passes for all the parks in Minnesota there, just like you would at any star park such as Itasca,
okay.
et cetera.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Huizenga, I have correction here. It's at 2 weeks. Oh, 2 weeks. Thank you. So, good. Any other questions from community members? Okay. We will lay over Senate File 850 for recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee for inclusion in the Omnibus Bonding Bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And just want to see if Senator Dame is here in the room. Senator Dame? Okay. If not, then Senator Coonan. Senator Coonan sent with Senate File 835. Senator Coonan, are you in the room?
Yep.
Oh, okay. All right. Welcome, Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bonding request from the City of Montevideo for levee construction. It appropriates $3,500,000 to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for a flood mitigation grant to the City of Montevideo. And I have with me today Mr. Steve Jones, the city manager, and then Ms. Angie Steinbeck, the community development director, and they will tell you more about the project in Montevideo.
And please state your name for the record.
My name is Steve Jones. I'm the city manager for the City of Montevideo. And Chairman and Committee, thank you for having us here. You heard quite a bit of information on flood, and I think actually a lot of success stories. And I think we're another one of those. We've given you quite a bit of information on, I think, what we consider a holistic approach to a floodplain management and floodplain hazard mitigation. And we would like to thank you, the state. I think we've had a number of partners, DNR, Homeland Security, FEMA, Army Corps of Engineers. And I just want to give you an example of kind of the difference it's made. We've had 5 federally declared disasters since 97, 97, 2001, 2009, 10, and 11. The 1997 flood and the 2001 floods, for just flood fighting purposes, were approximately a $1 million flood fight, which in the end was something the state and the federal government picked up a big share of that. By 2009, because of the changes that were made, that flood fight was about $200,000. By 2011, our last one, was less than $50,000 for flood fighting purposes. So I think it shows you the progress we're making, and with the help of all our partners, it's really helped us a lot. Another example, we were talking about sandbanks and some of the other communities. Again, an example, 1997, over a million sandbanks were used to protect our community. In 2011, we used 5,000. So there's been tremendous progress. Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to have Angie Steinbeck just give you a brief example of some of the partner things that help, and then I'd like to come back and just tell you a little bit more about this specific project.
Sure. Welcome, Ms. Steinbeck, and please state your full name for the record.
Angela Steinbeck, Community Development Director for the City of Montevideo. And as Steve said, I'm just going to go a little bit further in here. The levee project is just part of the City of Montevideo's Flood Hazard Mitigation Program. Our flood hazard mitigation goals are three-tiered and include eliminate damage, health, and safety issues associated with flooding. Number two, eliminate infrastructure problems during high water events. And number three, to permanently eliminate the need for costly disaster interventions. For example, with that, 127 homes, most in Smith Edition, a development in Montevideo, were purchased in a series of buyouts that spanned almost a decade. These homes were not protected by the levee system and were heavily flooded in 1997 and damaged or threatened in 2001. In 2009, FEMA did a study of the cost effectiveness of the purchase of 48 homes in flood-prone areas in Montevideo. Their study showed their investment of $1,123,145 in these 48 homes saved FEMA since 1997 $8,394,030, or a 747% return on their investment, which is outstanding. That investment only increases each year, and to date, 127 homes have been removed, not a mere 48, and a real return to FEMA, the state, and the city is even higher.
Any question from community members? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, can I just briefly go over the map and the cost?
Yes, you may proceed.
Thank you. We're really to the place where $3.5 million is a lot of money, but $3.5 million will get us done. Will get us finished. I know certainly the state gets frustrated with not having completion. This has been a 15-year project for the city of Montevideo and the state and the federal government. I just briefly want to show you the map. The portions that's up on the top and the portions that are more than in the dark blue are completed. So those are phase one and phase two of the levee project. The portion that's needed to be completed is the one that looks kind of like a almost like a half circle. The red portion, that's considered, we call it phase three. Phase three is a rebuild of an existing temporary levee that was built in 1969 by the Corps of Engineers. We're basically sitting with a levee system two-thirds built, but two-thirds is still not a levee completed, so we need to complete this last portion. Several things are important. If that 1969 levee, which is very weak, fails, about a third of the city of Montevideo would be flooded. And that's an area that is very commercial and industrial-related, some residential-related. And if you kind of look there, kind of in the middle, there's a little red circle. Uh-huh. That's the intersection of highways 212 and 7. So if you're going to western Minnesota and South Dakota, Highway 7 and 212 merge in Monty, and that's where they merge. And then just about 300 feet northwest of that is Highway 59. If that levee system fails, those three highways would be lost, and frankly, there would be almost no way except going down to the interstate or much further north to even get west. So the effect is not just in Monty. The effect is for commerce for the entire state. So that levee system actually protects that important intersection as well. Another thing besides protecting one-third of the town is, like many communities, FEMA has come out with new flood maps. They have not released ours because they're waiting for us to finish the project. They know we're almost there, but they're not going to wait much longer. And if they do release them, they're going to decertify our entire levee system, and one-third of the town, which is now in a B or C zone, will be in an A zone, and basically commerce in that area will just screech to a halt. So those are some of the issues. Again, we'd like to ask you to support this project. Again, we're almost there. We can get this done. I think once it's done, then we can go help other communities with our 15 years of expertise in this. So we really ask for your support.
Well, thank you very much. And we will lay over this bill, Senate File 835, for recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee for inclusion in the omnibus bonding bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Next is Senator Dam, Senate File 102. Senator Dams, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I am Senator Gary Dames, and I have with me today Jim Deering, the Public Works Project Coordinator for the City of Redwood Falls, Doug Goodrich, the RCRCA Executive Director, and Gary Veer, the Mayor of City of Redwood Falls. Today I'm here to introduce Senate File Number 102. Senate File Number 102 is a request for bonding in the amount of $7,825,000 for the Lake Redwood Reclamation Enhancement Project. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Jim Deering to give more specifics and details on the project.
Thank you, Senator.
Welcome, Mr. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Deering, Public Works Project Coordinator for the City of Redwood Falls. I thank you and I thank the committee for hearing us today. A brief history of why I'm here instead of speaking before Doug to my left is that I've worked 12 years on the watershed prior to coming to the Redwood or to the city itself. And in that time, we've worked hard to implement BMPs throughout the watershed. It's a 640 square mile watershed. The lake itself is 64 acres. It's 2.8 feet deep. And it has currently, and we'd like to dredge it, take out 650,000 cubic yards for $7.8 million with your help to 20-foot depth capacity. With that, the City of Redwood Falls also has a vested interest in the dam itself and the reservoir. We've been producing hydroelectric power. We are currently underway with a $3 million plus investment of upgrading the hydroelectric portion of the dam, and that would be in addition to the $7.8 million to dredge the Lake Redwood out. The return on investment would be about approximately 3.4 years, as stated in your handout sheet, roughly with reducing the amount of sediment coming into the lake. It originally started at 1.5 feet per year. We have reduced it to 0.13 feet per year. And that's with an $8 million investment that has gone into the watershed up above since 1994. And with that, it is a reservoir. It will continue to fill in, but it's got a 70-year life expectancy, 70 years plus, with the amount of effort that's currently going in and the continued effort that you'll see going in the Redwood River watershed with RCRCA and partners like Area 2, Minnesota River Basins Incorporated. So the longevity of this project will continue to grow from the 70 years that we're projecting out farther. But with that, like I said, it will still fill in over these 70 years. At 0.13 feet, which is about 16,500 tons of sediment will be trapping. That basically is equivalent of $2 million a year in general BMP implementation if you're doing NRCS or Soil Water District BMPs that they're putting in. So it will, ironically, also be a BMP for sedimentation downstream in the Minnesota River and Lake Pepin. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Doug Goodrich to speak on behalf of the Redwood River Clean Water Project and some of the efforts.
Welcome, Mr. Goodrich. And please say your full name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Douglas Goodrich. I'm the executive director at the Redwood Cottonwood Rivers Control Area. We're a joint powers organization of an 8-county board. This project and the Lake Redwood project is one of the main points of the organization since it was started in 1983. This is our 30th year. Flood control and large projects is why groups like ourselves have started, and partners such as Area 2 Minnesota River Basins Projects. Our Soil and Water District partners and NRCS partners is who we work with. There's some history in the Redwood River watershed. The reason for the first Clean Water Partnership grant through the MPCA, that program contract number one was the Redwood River Clean Water Project. And that was granted to RCRCA. Since then, we've done plenty of work on the Redwood River to try and get it to a point where the lake could be salvaged and brought back to a state of where it was. And as Jim had alluded to earlier here, that we're currently at the point where it's time to make good on that. Other concerns in the Redwood River that this lake project would help address: TMDL impairments. This does act as a BMP as well as an area for other things. Currently, there are TMDL problems in the river that are being addressed, and we've made good headway on them, as shown by data at our organization. Turbidity is coming down, and this will help extend the project and its recreational uses into the future, making it a better buy now because of the amount of work we've put into it. Close to $3 million worth of funds have been cost share on the lands around the area to hold sediment and water on the land to make this even more worthy a project, again, with our partners in the area. So with that, a little bit of history maybe in the area and the regional significance, we'll turn it over to the mayor of Redwood Falls, Gary Revere.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Gary Revere.
I'm welcome, the mayor
of Redwood Falls. Thank you, Senator. Redwood Falls is somewhat of a unique community. We've heard testimony prior to this time about parks that are used, recreation areas, power sources, dikes. We've been doing this on our own. And we have received help from some legacy funds at our park. If you don't know, the park that is known by the Dakota people as Red Tree Nation, but it's known by the people of Minnesota as Alexander Ramsey Park. It was instituted as a state park in 1912. In 1957, as the state was looking for ways to save money, they decided that they didn't want a state park within the corporate limits of a city, and that was the case for our park. So we purchased it from the state for $1 and have maintained it ever since. And what this does to us is we are the second highest per capita spender on recreation, arts, and the humanities. And our community is proud of it. They have come to the plate time after time, reinvesting in our community. Ramsey Park, or Red Tree Nation Park, is the largest municipal park in Minnesota. Now, this is maintained by a community of 5,500 people. And I think that's admirable that our people have stepped up to the plate time after time to continue this very special area. It's a holy area to the Dakota people. The Dakota people call this area Shashayape Otowe, or place or village where they paint the tree red. Now, what does that have to do with this reservoir? Well, the reservoir was built in 1902 for two reasons. One was to provide hydroelectric power. The second, as a byproduct of it, was to provide recreational opportunities in an area that just didn't have any lakes. There's only two lakes in the whole county of Redwood, and they're both man-made. That doesn't leave us with a lot of water, as many people in northern Minnesota are used to. The lake was used recreationally, and it was used for hydroelectric power. The first use of the power that comes as the Redwood River falls over 200 feet to the Minnesota River was as a government sawmill built in 1855. Now, this reservoir has held this water in the past to mitigate flood problems that we had not only at our power plant, but also in this park that I refer to as Red Tree Nation in Ramsey Park. We had major floods time after time after time until we could hold some of the water back. Well, that has totally been negated because there is no water to be held. The average depth is probably under 2 feet. And a good example, a couple of years ago, everyone in Redwood woke up to a giant cross being placed out in the middle of the lake, and it was to signify the Dead Sea. And we have invested, just this year we're investing, almost $4 million in a new hydroelectric generator. Most of our power is coming from green sources. We have two large generators, wind generators, towers close to the city. We do get a lot of our power from the dams out in South Dakota, and we do get it from our local generation with our hydro plant. And unless we can do something to create the volume of water that's needed and also to hold back the floodwaters, we're going to be up a creek without a paddle, as the proverbial saying goes. So this is something that has regional significance, especially for recreation. I did a look at some of the reports from 2012, the people that attended our campground, which we fund ourselves. That campground, the primary usage was from people from 100 to 200 miles away. And many of those, if you look at the names and the places they come from, are from the Twin City area. And we enjoy having them come out and learn about our community, learn about what we have to offer, learn about our history. So I'm here to show support from the city of Redwood Falls and to encourage you to give us a positive look and to think of the opportunities. I also invite you to come out and call me before you do. I'd be happy to give you a tour of the entire area. There are some very special things to see. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senators.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for history and the contribution of your citizen there. I learned a new word today, shashayape.
So. Shashayape, yes. And very few people can say that. I congratulate you.
Thank you. And any comment or question from the committee members?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just in closing, I'd just like to just go through a few things here. Lake Redwood was created in 1902. Mm-hmm. It was 27 feet deep at that point in time. Currently, as Mayor Revere alluded to, it's probably around that two-foot stage. Since 1983, there have been several partners that have come in helped in order to reduce the sediment and reduce that. It was coming in at a point of about 2 feet per acre annually, and now it's reduced down to about one-tenth of a foot per acre annually. So the funding of the Lake Redwood Reclamation Enhancement Project would allow the community to implement environmental economic plans and will help us direct the future of the management and the use of Lake Redwood. And your support in this project would be truly appreciated. And for that, thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And we will consider it. And we'll lay over Senate File 104. 102. For recommendation to the capital investment for inclusion in the omnibus bonding bill. Okay, and next is Senator Dean, Senate File 538.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Gary Dames, and with me today I have Carrie Nitzke, the Executive Director of Area 2. I have Bob Moline, who is the Chairman of the Area 2 Board of Directors, and I have Rick from Lyon County. He's on the board, the County Commissioner from Lyon County, and also on the Area 2 Board. Senate File Number 538 is a bill for an appropriation of $120,000 that's being requested for the from the general fund for the Board of Soil and Water Resources, which is a 9-county joint powers board that works with flood management in the Minnesota River Basin projects. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Carrie Nitzke to give us further information on the request.
Okay, welcome. And please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Carrie Nitzke. I'm the Executive Director for Area 2, Minnesota River Basin Projects Incorporated, based out of Marshall. As Senator Dames mentioned, we are here on behalf of Senate File 538, requesting continued funding of our joint powers organization. This request was also included in the governor's budget for the next biennium. Handouts to you have been provided, looking like this. And what that does is it recaps Area 2's history, the statutory purpose, and a brief educational piece on the Buffalo Ridge. The ridge, as you may more commonly know it, is basically known for the hundreds of wind turbine generators located upon it, although its geological name is actually the Coteau de Prairie, named by French explorers as Coteau means slope. This very unique glacial deposit in southwestern Minnesota is up to 100 miles wide, 200 miles long, and is up to 1,000 feet thick of just glacial deposits. And it forms that divide that goes from the Jim River on the west side in South Dakota and the Minnesota River on the east side that comes into Minnesota. From the tip of that coteau by Summit, South Dakota, all the way to the outlet of the Minnesota River here in the Twin Cities, there's over 1,300 feet of drop, a fall. That is more from the Twin Cities to the Gulf of Mexico, if you can envision that. This geologic formation also creates extreme elevation drops within our watersheds. Just within the Lac La Parle watershed, you'll have some areas where there's over 80 feet per mile of fall. And in the Redwood River, you'll see 50 feet of fall per mile. When you contrast this to the Red River Valley, which you've been hearing about earlier, if you think about spilling a cup of coffee on your kitchen floor or even on the table in front of you, in the Red River Valley, that water is just going to spread out and equalize everywhere. The kind of flooding we have is you take that cup of coffee and you pour it down the playground slide. It's just going to gain speed and force as it goes down, and as it does, it's going to take the sediment and the stream banks and everything with it. So there's a big difference in the flooding just from one area of the state of Minnesota to the other. This coteau also creates kind of a very unique secondary form of flooding. Because it is tilted from Ortonville to Mankato, it also allows the water to jump watershed boundaries. So the Yellow Bank jumps over into the Lac La Parle. The Lac La Parle will go into the Yellow Medicine, onto the Redwood, onto the Cottonwood, all the way down to Mankato. So really our flooding dilemmas, because of the coteau, are almost twofold. And this is primarily why Area 2 Minnesota River Basin Projects was created way back in 1978, proudly 35 years ago. This 9-county joint powers board, again, was created by statute. And at that time, there was over $250,000 a year appropriated to do our work of flood mitigation in southwestern Minnesota. We, as you can tell, we are very proactive to flooding. We're out there looking for the projects to hold that water back, not so much the reactive. We're not out there building levees and dealing with the flooding at hand. We're more so preventing those flood damages before they come. That appropriation has dwindled over the years. By the mid-1980s, the amount that came to Area 2 has dwindled 25% down to $189,000. That funding level remained solid until about 2001, and through the Ventura administration, there was a move to basically eliminate all joint powers organizations, of which there were 10 at that time. Three survived, and probably were one of the three. But, of course, that came at a cost. There was another 25% cut, took us down to $140,000 a year, and then another cut where we were at $105,000 annually. Since that time, we have regained back to the $120,000 a year, which we are very proud and very successful, and we can show you the projects and the work that we get done very effectively. The 9-member counties of Area 2 have proven their commitment. As those grant funds have diminished, they certainly could have lessened their 25% share, but they never have. Their commitment has stayed solid, and they submit over $87,000 per year to match that $120,000 to keep that office budget going. Area 2 has successfully proven that it can do more with less, as the budget cuts have asked us to do. This long-standing, successful, and beneficial partnership between Area 2 and the state of Minnesota continues today as it was started those 35 years ago. By doing our part to lessen the flood damage is to keep those sediments in nutrients on the land at the headwaters, we're bettering the Minnesota River, the Mississippi River, and essentially the state of Minnesota for generations to come. I thank you for listening to our testimony today. At this point, I would like to ask our chairman of the board, Maury County Commissioner Bob Moline, for his thoughts.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Moline. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and all the committee members. My name is Bob Moline. I'm Maury County Commissioner, and I currently chair the board of Area 2. And as stated earlier, our executive director, Carrie, she's been with this agency for over 20 years, and she's done a fantastic job. We help many counties with flood retention. It was mentioned earlier in the hearing today about water ponding up in the Moorhead area. We deal with water retention, and that's what we deal with, is hold water back for approximately 72 hours to try to get away from the flooding that's going on. We also help many soil and water districts in our counties, and they always come to us and want to help, and we want to help them back also. But one thing to remember, that without the work of Area 2, we would have much more flooding downstream, which goes into eastern Minnesota and further on down into the Gulf. And we have been at this projects for 35 years, and we want to keep these projects going. So I would hopefully that this committee would consider our appropriation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would yield the floor to our Lyon County Commissioner, Rick Anderson, if he has any comments to make, Mr. Chair.
Sure. And welcome. Please state your full name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rick Anderson. I'm currently the Lyon County Board Chair and serve as an alternate on Area 2. In my 3 years involved with Area 2, I think it's been a great learning process. I think it's our responsibility in Southwest Minnesota to help prevent some of the flooding that occurs downstream, and with this projects that we put on the ground, I think we're able to help and hopefully help out our neighbors, considering with Montevideo and Redwood, and as Commissioner Moline said, all of the partners downstream. So again, I would just ask for your support in helping us keep this good organization going. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any question from committee members? Okay, thank you very much. We shall lay over Senate File 538 for possible inclusion in the Division Omnibus Bill. Thank you very much, Senator Dean.
Senator Saxhawk, Senate File 428.
Thank you, Chairman Tomasoni, members. As you say, we are presenting Senate File 428. This bill will provide an appropriation for Explore Minnesota Tourism. As you know, tourism is one of the great economic drivers of the land of 10,000 lakes, and two of our premier tourist destinations are the city of Duluth and the Mall of America. And so with me today, I have Terry Mattson, President and CEO of Visit Duluth, Doug Killian, Director of Tourism for the Mall of America. They're both going to give some brief testimony and answer any questions.
Well, let's go first.
I'm Terry Mattson from Visit Duluth. Chairman Tomasoni, I'll speak first and then turn things over to Doug. It's a pleasure to be here asking for your strong support of Senate File 428 today. I want to thank Senator Saxog for being the lead author on this bill and his support and help along the way. I also recognize Governor Mark Dayton and his staff, as this is part of the Governor's Office's vision for economic development. This is serious economic development for the state of Minnesota. Tourism has been very good to this state, but there are certainly opportunities for us to do better in terms of being an economic engine for the tourism and hospitality industry, as well as opening doors for other sectors. There's statewide support for this plan and for this bill. I want to point out that you have a number of documents that were forwarded earlier. There's 107 tourism organizations throughout the state of Minnesota representing all four corners and everywhere in between that are firmly behind this proposal. There's some pretty incredible statistics that go along with the leisure and hospitality industry. It's a $12 billion a year industry in the state of Minnesota. That's direct spending. It represents over 240,000 jobs for Minnesotans. It's a $769 million generator of sales tax revenues every year for the state of Minnesota. That's an impressive figure, representing about 17% of all state sales tax revenues. The fact of the matter and why we're here today is we need to be more competitive. We're missing opportunities to create more sales tax revenues, to create more revenues for the private sector, and to create more jobs for Minnesotans. We currently rank 30th in the United States of America in terms of the promotional budget dedicated to promoting travel and tourism. The average spending investment in tourism promotion for the other states in the U.S. is $14 million a year. We're currently at $8 million a year. This proposal extends that to $16 million a year and would definitely make us more competitive in new markets. This is particularly critical when we look at our competitive set. We need to reach out to new markets, to new visitors. This is for advertising, promotion, for marketing. And if we look at nearby states that we're losing a lot of visitors to, states like Michigan with the Pure Michigan campaign, Wisconsin, Wyoming, these are states that Michigan, for example, is investing about $30 million a year. Why? Because it makes solid economic sense and it has a tremendous return on investment. In fact, that return on investment is about 8-1, according to a recent study. That is, for every $1 invested in travel and tourism promotion through Explore Minnesota, generates $8 in terms of its return with state and local sales taxes. This is a high-growth industry. I mentioned we can do better. Yes, we can. But we're investing in our strengths with this proposal. In the period 2003 to 2010, there was a 35% growth rate in leisure and hospitality in the state of Minnesota, compared to 11% in the other sectors. This is a chance to make Minnesota more competitive. I'm here to answer more questions, along with Doug's testimony. We have great products. We have a great infrastructure. We have great natural resources. What we need is the additional horsepower to get the word out on this great state. We need to get behind Explore Minnesota Tourism. There's people in our industry throughout the state that are doing that. We encourage your support of this bill. We encourage your support of Governor Dayton, and we encourage your support of travel and tourism in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Mattson? Mr. Killeen?
Okay, yeah, thanks again for your time today. We really appreciate your interest in this. And I'm Doug Killian. I'm Senior Director of International Tourism from All of America. And as Terry stated, you know, this is an $11.9 billion industry in the state. It provides 240,000 jobs. It has a very high return on investment. We do research at Mall of America, and for every $1 that a tourist spends at Mall of America, which is defined as people who visit from outside the 150-mile radius, they spend at least $3 more in the state economy on dining, hotels, professional sports, theaters, museums, the wonderful resorts we have. So tourism, again, is a tremendous economic provider for the state. And, as, you know, as Terry mentioned, and I think we all know, just in the Twin Cities alone, we're being bombarded by other states in their tourism advertising, Montana, South Dakota, Wisconsin. The list goes on and on. And, you know, we're losing market share. Terry mentioned the budget for the Explore Minnesota Tourism. It's currently at the 1990 level of funding. And I can personally say the Explore Minnesota Tourism team is excellent. I travel with them to travel shows throughout the United States and other parts of the world. They're top-notch, but they simply need more money to really promote this great state and bring tourists here. And on a national level, too, about a year and a half ago, President Obama, by executive order, streamlined visa applications for people in China, Brazil, and India. And it's had the effect of bringing in many more visitors to this country. Also, he mandated that the country, the U.S. Commerce Department, create a national tourism strategy, which it did. And there's also a brand new agency called Brand USA, which is completely dedicated to bringing the international visitors to the United States, and especially to the states like Minnesota, you know, New York, California, Florida, Las Vegas. They have large tourism budgets, and they go to international shows. But states like Minnesota need Brand USA support. But it's dependent on having matching dollars from Explore Minnesota Tourism and other organizations like Mall of America. So from a national and international standpoint, it's very important as well. So, again, we're just very thankful for your time. You know, another interesting comparison is the EMT budget right now is the same. The Wisconsin Dells has a bigger budget than Explore Minnesota Tourism. You know, we have all these fabulous resources in our state. We want to promote it. We want to create more jobs, more economic benefits to help the entire state and all the great activities we have here. So, again, thank you for your time, and certainly take any questions you might have.
Are there any questions of the witnesses? Senator Saxon, this is like really easy to understand, a two-line bill.
It is.
We should have more bills like this.
It is, Mr. Chair, and members, and it's and you know the whole, as this relates to economic development, it's pretty easy to understand, too. This is just marketing to bring in money to Minnesota for a great natural resource that we have.
Senator Rood, were you about to ask a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but a comment. Coming from the Brainerd Lakes area, I fully understand how important tourism is. But I think if you look on the back of the sheet, the Tourism Growth Coalition, I think that you will see that it not only affects the Heartland and Duluth and the Mall of America, there are places all over the whole state of Minnesota, and I think that's the important piece. It's not just certain pockets of wonderful places to visit. It's our whole state. And so I thank Senator Saxon for bringing this bill forward.
Yeah, you know, another point, too, is that
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. If I make one just follow-up comment?
Yes.
Thank you. And thank you for that comment. But the extra money that would be dedicated under the proposed increase in the Explore Minnesota Tourism budget has been very carefully. They know where that money is going to go. It's going to go in new markets like Chicago, which is a very strong tourism market for Minnesota, Kansas City, and many other markets. So there's a very specific strategy behind the budget increase.
Is there any calculation as to how much the increase in tourism would be as a result of the increase, the amount of money that's planning to be invested here?
Mr. Chairman, I think I can answer that question for you very quickly. I don't have it committed to memory, but I know it's in some of the information. We also have in the audience John Edmond and Colleen Tullison from Explore Minnesota that could probably answer some of these at a little bit greater depth, but if you bear with me for 2 seconds, using ballpark numbers, because the budgets have varied slightly during this whole process that we've been working on for about 2 years, but the additional expenditures would generate an estimated $590 million in traveler spending in the state of Minnesota, would create an additional 7,000 jobs and $150 million in income, and $56 million in new state and local tax revenues. So that's a pretty serious return on investment. Again, it's 8-1 in the most recent study. For every $1 of state money invested in Explore Minnesota Tourism, ad campaigns will return $8 in state and local tax revenue. So it's very substantial. I've been in this business for almost 30 years. I deal with the cause and effect and see firsthand what a revenue generator our efforts have been for the city of Duluth and for northeastern Minnesota, and we want to bring that kind of effort and rationale into providing more horsepower to explore Minnesota tourism. So we'd appreciate your support. Thank you.
Still a good return.
I don't think we can say that.
So, Mr. Chair?
So, anyway, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
If there's Senator, comments.
I just want to make a comment. I'd just like to encourage Explore Minnesota to not overlook and include the culture front of our community and as a destination, you know, particularly like my district, Sweet Hollow, Yeruso, and Hmong Village and Hmong Town and all those places. I think when people from when international traveler come into town, if they do get homesick, you know, we have Southeast Asian front here. And if they're from German, New Ulm's just about 2 hours away.
Senator, you must have Morelli's in your district, too.
Morelli's, yes. I just want to encourage that we don't overlook those as a destination.
Senator Dietrich.
I was going to ask, thank you, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask because one of the testifiers mentioned the Wisconsin Dells budget is larger than ours, and what is their budget? You know?
Mr. Killeen.
John Edmund is here. I believe it's in the $12 to $14 million annual range, so, you know, compared to our 8.5.
So. Mr. Edmund, do you know the answer to that? Because no, you don't know the answer?
Yeah.
No? Okay. All right, he doesn't know either.
Fairly sure that's a good ballpark number.
No.
Yep, range.
Got a better figure?
Yeah. We can also get that specific number for you soon.
Yeah, we don't want to be guessing on tape here, so.
No, I just said, Mr. Chair, I just thought it was a good little tidbit.
It is interesting, but we should actually know what they think. Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, if not, then Senator Sachs, I'll give you any final questions or comments.
We appreciate the committee's support for sure. And Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that you'd like to set Senate File 428 aside and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
That's correct, Senator Saxhawk.
All right. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, so we'll lay Senate File 428 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus economic development bill. Senator Dibble. Thank you, Senator Dibble, and for being patient and for all the people who came here for being patient. Senator Dibble, I think we got about 20 or 25 minutes. Can you do this in that time or
more time? I have to, Mr. Chair. I have a committee to go chair myself.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Not all too
right.
Long from now. So thank you, okay. Mr. Chair and members. I bring Senate File 811 to you, which would add another $25 million in general fund resources to an array of housing programs and services provided through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. This would be above the $75 million in base funding that we provide across this array of services presently. And the goal of these efforts, Mr. Chair and members, is to address and prevent homelessness, folks without homes, and create workforce housing. I'll be very brief in my description of the bill. We have folks who can illuminate further, but we know from a report that was released just a few days ago that the level of affordability, particularly for rental in Minnesota, has decreased quite dramatically. That's the Minnesota Out of Reach report. The effects, of course, and we've had some discussion already about this in this committee, previous presentations, the effects on family stability, children's ability to succeed in school, health outcomes, the opportunity to create jobs through this sort of funding is extremely important because, of course, if we fund some of these programs, we'll be building housing, and we have developers who would benefit, so this would be a jobs bill. But also, Mr. Chair, members, we know that
businesses need to house workers, so it has a long-term positive effect on our economy as well. For that and a whole array of reasons, this is a good bill, worthy of support. It would not even bring us back up to some of the higher levels of support that we provided for housing and these particular programs in the past. We would still be short a little bit from some of our efforts in past years. Mr. Chair, we have the A130190 amendment coming around that came from the revisers to put it in proper appropriation form. It's the same bill, it's just formatted differently.
So, members, this is just the technical amendment that, even though it looks like a delete everything amendment, it is a delete everything amendment. It just changes the way the bill is written. And so this is the author's amendment, and this is the first committee it's been in. So Senator Dibble moves the A130190 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. Okay, Senator Dibble.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, you can read the different programs that are enumerated in the bill and the amounts for each. And there's a handout that you have that make it a little easier to follow along. That's this handout. And on the reverse, you see a little matrix. And you can just read the columns. The 2012-2013 funding level, the proposed increase, that's the biennial increase, so you can split that out and divide each of those by two for the annual increase, and the level to which we would increase the base fund appropriation for each of these. The challenge program, we know, is one of the most flexible programs that the Housing Finance Agency has, and it's used often to match local effort, and other sorts of efforts are matched for the purpose of providing affordable housing development statewide. The Housing Trust Fund, that's for rental assistance, particularly for those who previously were homeless. The Rental Rehabilitation Program, that's assistance for rehabilitation of smaller rental properties. Family Homelessness Prevention, we would be adding $2.5 or $1.25 million per year. And that's to help folks who are transitioning out of homelessness. It provides some practical support, or it prevents people from falling into homelessness as well. And that's an extremely important, small dollar, but extremely important program to keep folks stable, and it prevents a lot of costs down the line. Homeownership Assistance Fund, what that does is provide some down payment and closing cost assistance. Housing preservation, that is, which one is that? That's housing preservation. And Mr. Chair, we take advantage of federal funds in the housing preservation program, housing rehabilitation, or housing for rehabilitating single family housing, homeownership education, counseling, and training to help folks in this time that we have with folks who are first starting to look at buying homes and or avoiding foreclosure. And then the capacity building grants, something that we started funding just a few years ago, and that's helping different agencies, different units of government, and different community-based organizations assist with forecasting and planning for housing needs across the state.
Senator Dietzig, you have a question or a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble answered it.
Oh, okay. Good job, Senator.
All right. I anticipated your question. Okay. Mr. Chair, we have Liz Coppola, who is chair of the Homes for All Coalition, who is part of the large effort of many, many folks here who have pulled together this initiative.
Ms. Coppola, please say your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Liz Coppola. I work as executive director of the Statewide Coalition for the Homeless, and I'm here today, as Senator Dibble mentioned, as part of the broader Homes for All Coalition, where dozens of housing and homeless groups supporting strategic investments in proven programs. We are joined in our comprehensive and coordinated approach by groups ranging from healthcare professionals, school districts, faith communities, and economic development authorities, who have all seen the impact of homelessness and housing instability on children, classrooms, and communities. As Senator Dibble mentioned, on any given night in Minnesota, there are over 10,000 people who are homeless. Last year, Grace House in Grand Rapids turned away 368 people from full shelter. AEOA up on the range turned away 480 people from their shelters in Virginia and Hibbing. These numbers are similar across the state. These numbers are staggering, and behind each one is a story. Take Tony, for example. He and his wife are separated. He moved into a small one-bedroom apartment. She lived with their four girls in another town. She died suddenly from a diabetic reaction of some sort. He didn't have funeral leave and ended up losing his job. In subsequent positions, he was a great employee, but he struggled with a sudden responsibility of caring for four grieving children, working out the logistics of daycare, doing their hair, making a happy home. His children came first, always, and he found it hard to maintain stable employment. He and the girls ended up in shelter. After 5 months in shelter, he found stability in a transitional housing program and has now been able to maintain a job and provide for his children. We know rent assistance paired with services works to stabilize vulnerable families. SF 811 represents one half of our United request, the housing side. It's a multifaceted request that addresses numerous proven programs that stabilize families, prevent and end homelessness, and create workforce housing. I won't go into a lot of detail on all the particular funding needs. Rather, I will briefly highlight how some of these programs have become important tools used by many of our partners to address homelessness. The first program I'd like to address is the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. In 2010 and 2011, this program served more than 16,000 households across the state. This is a program that meets the pragmatic needs of families at risk of homelessness, everything from rental deposit and payment assistance to mortgage and transportation expense assistance. Prevention, by nature, meets the cost-conscious concerns of government. They say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In this case, FHPAP costs $842 per household on average versus the thousands of dollars it costs once a family ends up in shelter or on the street. For those of you who might be concerned that programs like this are imbalanced in terms of their geographic reach, let me assure you this is not the case. 45% of FHPAP funds were allocated in Greater Minnesota. The Housing Trust Fund is another program that plays a critical role in the way Minnesota responds to homelessness. This program provides rental assistance for households that have experienced homelessness. Hearth Connection, a nonprofit that offers supportive services through a network of providers through three regional programs, relies on this rental assistance to support over 350 households per year. Like FHPAP, the Housing Trust Fund has tremendous reach, and Hearth Connection uses approximately 43% of this resource in Greater Minnesota. Lastly, a word about capacity building grants provided through Minnesota Housing. Among the most important uses of this program is support for Greater Minnesota Continuums of Care. COCs are responsible for organizing and delivering housing and services such as prevention, outreach and assessment, emergency shelter, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing, along with affordable housing. The COCs are able to access over $20 million in federal funds annually by working together. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak here today. According to the latest information released by Wilder, as Senator Dibble mentioned, we know that housing remains out of reach for far too many Minnesotans, especially children and youth. We also know what works to fix this problem. And I'll introduce both a developer and a service provider to speak to that, but I just want to thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Ms. Guacala.
Who's Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I blanked on the housing preservation program. That's the PERIF program that you can see about four down, which is preservation loans for subsidized rental housing.
Yeah. Cool. Go ahead.
Jamie Thielen.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Once again, Jamie Thielen. I'm CEO of Sand Companies. We're a for-profit developer of housing projects. We've been in business for about 20 years. We have about 550 employees. Our home office is in Wade Park, and we also have offices in Rogers and in St. Paul. And like I mentioned, a big part of our company is we do develop housing. We've developed over 2,000 rental units, mostly in Minnesota. And a big part of that is also workforce housing that we've developed. One of the couple projects we're working on now are We're co-developing the Common Bond VA project on the St. Cloud campus and the campus at the Upper Post. A couple projects we're working on. We've also done over 24 projects with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency through their various funding. What I want to speak on behalf today is specifically the challenge funds that we've utilized on numerous projects. One of the most recent ones is a project that opened up in 2009, a 54-unit workforce housing project called Maple Village and in Maple Grove. We borrowed $936,000 in funding from the Challenge Fund, which helped us leverage and bring in about $6.8 million in private equity from the sale of federal tax credits. And also then we were able to leverage about $400,000 in other funding from the city along with the Met Council to complete that project. Those 54 units leased up in less than 45 days. It allows people, families living in Maple Village, making $53,000 or less, a family of five, to rent a three-bedroom, fully furnished or full apartment for $1,100 a month, which is probably 25 to 30% lower than market rents in that area. Also, we just started a second phase there that we're opening up, 48 units right next to it, another workforce housing project in just a few weeks here. And the pre-leasing, it is pretty apparent that we're going to lease that 48 units in probably less than 30 days. So I don't think there's a lot of question on some of the demands. But unique about the challenge that we're seeing and how we think it's a really good program is it's really geared toward jobs and economic development and the flexibility. Minnesota Housing does a great job in allocating their funds. Sometimes just with the priorities with transit and homeless housing, sometimes the greater Minnesota Housing projects don't score quite as well, so sometimes they have tougher getting selection. And these Housing Challenge Funds are a great way to fill those gaps in those projects. There's lots of communities like Roseau, War Road, Worthington, Thief River Falls that are seeing lots of job growth but just don't have the housing. We were just recently had staff up in Roseau. The governor and commissioner were up there. And right now the vacancy in Roseau is Roseau County is 2.4%. And then just for affordable, the vacancy is 1.4%. So an extreme need. And just one thing, Mark Maxfield Research did complete a study up there, and they found the common theme among top employers is that there's a short supply of rental units in the area, as many new hires, particularly entry-level workers, have trouble finding housing. And many of these for-sale homes on the market are older, smaller, or needing repair and don't fit the family housing needs of the workforce. That's what we're hearing from the employers in these areas. So we really look forward to support for the Housing Challenge Funds because it's really flexible funds that we can use specifically for areas for that are seeing some of that growth.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Okay. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Matt Socek. I'm a project manager and also the public policy coordinator for Project for Pride and Living. If you're not familiar with us, PPL, we've been a housing developer and service provider since 1972. We own over 1,100 units of rental housing throughout the Twin Cities metropolitan area. I'd like to thank Senator Dibble for putting forth Senate File 811. The main point I would make to you today is quite simply that public investment in housing are dollars well spent. Housing investments have a positive effect on from a community development standpoint. It takes blighted or underutilized housing and turns it into vibrant hubs of activity. To illustrate this, you simply need to walk out the door of the Capitol here, drive down University Avenue into Minneapolis, or down West 7th Street into St. Paul. Public investments in these projects, to the extent that there is public investment, has leveraged a much greater level of private investment. In other words, it doesn't just make it look good out there. It also creates economic development and jobs. And I think most pertinently to my organization, certainly most central to the mission of my organization, is that affordable housing creates a platform for attainment of stability and greater self-sufficiency for families and individuals. Safe, decent housing at affordable rents allows people to focus on other more important things, perhaps, like retaining or improving employment situations or academic achievement, both for adults and kids. I recently had the opportunity to meet a PPL participant, and she told me a little bit about her story, which I was quite moved by. She had been homeless for the 5 years prior to coming to PPL, with two small children under the age of 5 years old that she basically dragged with her from shelter to shelter, from family friend or relative to family friend or relative. In large part to the unsustainable nature of this situation, she fell ill with pulmonary hypertension and lost her minimum wage job. That's when she came to us. With the platform our housing provided, she was able to find and retain a job, engage in college coursework, and today she recently attained a degree in business management, an associate's degree in business management. Her children certainly seem happy. I'm told they're achieving well in school. As I looked at the smiling family, I couldn't help but to think how different it could have been if not for the stable platform that the housing provided for her. She fully understands that the public resources that helped her are in scarce supply, and therefore she set a goal for herself to work herself off of public assistance so that others in similarly bad situations might benefit from it. At PPL, we hear dozens of these kind of stories every year. It can't be overstated, the positive effect that the platform provided by affordable housing creates for families and individuals in our communities. Again, Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Dibble, I thank you for putting this forth, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Susick. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Senator Dibble, you have about four testifiers on the list here, and I think we've got about 10 minutes. Can we fit them in?
Mr. Chair, I think they initiated themselves to be placed on this list.
All right, then let's see. Can we have Gene Lee and Long Yang come to the table if you're both here? And if you, I don't want to limit your testimony, but if you can expedite it, it would be nice.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and also for the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium, which includes over 20 service provider organizations covering a broad range of culturally and bilingual services for the community and for veterans. This includes and is not limited to education, training, employment, health care, housing, legal services, children and family services, elderly services, victim services, and veteran services. We work with the populations most in need of help, but who receive the least amount of help and services unless we do it. We provide the most bang for the buck and return on investment than other nonprofits for the same funds. However, we have barriers in overcoming access to funding because of discrimination. We also have unique strategies that have benefited other organizations, and you were given some information at your offices that is too lengthy to go into here. However, I do want to point out as far as what you see as the NCHEC certification. This NeighborWorks America was created by an act of Congress to train HUD personnel and counselors in housing education and training, counseling and education nationwide. So they are the highest standard. They even train the Minnesota Home Ownership Center people and people within that network. Our problem is the processes by which funds are accessed, or there are barriers to the funding. One of them being that if you are not getting funded by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency through any of these, or through this particular program, the HECAT, we have to go out of state to get the certification that Minnesota law mandates, and we have to pay for it ourselves, versus those organizations which have priorities are the larger organizations that get the funding, and they get to be educated here in Minnesota and have the funds pay for that. So there's certain inequities there. We also included the same thing that went with Council. I'll be brief. This does reflect on jobs and workforce housing and returns on investment and government redesign. On the second handout, we did talk about the need to redesign government and the way the process is as far as the funding. And I just want to say that one of the returns on investment that's excluded from is the lack of access because of the way the system is structured to access HUD or federal dollars for program staff and funds. And I'll let the other members talk about their experiences.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Who wants to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, a member of the committee. My name is Sa Vang on behalf of Yang Long. I'm the president of the Hmong American Mutual Assistance Association in North Minneapolis. As you may know, the last several years, the housing crash, and we, the new Americans who lost the very high pricing housing in the suburbs, moving back to the North Minneapolis, which is a little bit cheaper. However, since the credit rate by the bank, and now we cannot buy our own home, and we have to return to the area that have rental housing. Our organization, Hmong American Mutual, do have staffing in housing, but we are not funded, so we have to do a volunteer. We would like to have some money to come into the regular nonprofit, which we family to the cultural, the ethnic experience that we can provide language for them to understand how they can approach the private housing sector, the government housing, the public housing, things like that. And most of the time, the major organization get the fund, and the little organization like us, who we have more experience on the cultural background of the new American, we don't get the funding. So our people really suffer on the housing area. So I'm here to ask for your please and pledge some money to the small organization like ours.
Okay, thank you. And do you want to say something also?
Hello, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and the Senate Committee. My name is Kevin Vang from the organization which is called Hmong Eating Council in Minnesota. So I'm here today. I also support Mrs. Lee's statement and support Mr. Vang's statement. We are the new American to the United States of America. We have an older generation and younger generation. So we are lack of education for home buyer and home owner, something like that. So we are the small organization. We also will be serving them for the crisis of the housing crash, something like that. So I'm here today to ask for a funding for us in order for us to serve our community and give some educational to our community. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Is that everybody? That's everybody, right? Do you have, so you want to testify?
Yes, I would.
Okay, go ahead. We got a couple minutes.
I'll make it quick.
All right. And just say your name for the record so we know who you are and who you're representing.
Thank you, Madam Sir. My name is David Sweet, and I'm here to testify today about a crisis that happened when I was demonstrating at Hennepin County Government Center during the Occupy period. And subsequent to that, me and the NASA supercomputer specialist had our ceiling measured by the city.
Mr. Sweet, does this have something to do with this bill?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
The bottom line is that we ended up getting a notice that we were going to be asked to leave the premises without any hearing, without because this 40-year-old building, well, the ceiling was 2 inches shy of code. So naturally, this was very disruptive when it's 30 below zero, and basically I became homeless. So I was very upset that there wasn't any critical path. And so I found that the programs we had were very, very important, because people are facing life and death situations when it's sub-zero temperatures and people are being asked to move out of their homes without even a hearing. So I ask that some of those things be reflected in the decision today on this funding. So I also work on behalf as an advocate for our veterans, so I know many of them are homeless, and I'd appreciate your consideration to the fact that they have worked hard to protect our freedoms, and the least we can do is make sure they don't die from being homeless. I did attend the Simpsons Memorial, where we had 163 people die, and Senator John Marty attended that event. So this is a life and death issue, unlike some other issues where people want $30 million to shoot movies. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I appreciate your testimony. Senator Dibble, any final comments?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think my testifier made the case better than I could. Just important to reflect on the fact that affordability, both in rental and home ownership, is decreasing in our state and in our region, and we know how fundamental and how basic housing is. We have the opportunity to save people from the brink of crisis and end up saving ourselves a lot of effort in other areas, whether that be healthcare, public safety, education, et cetera. And like I said before, even if we add $25 million to the base across these programs, we still won't be making the same effort as we have in the past. We have a lot of ground to make up.
Okay. Well, we're hearing a lot of serious concerns about housing in Minnesota, that's for sure, and how important it is to everybody. So I appreciate everybody's testimony. Does any of the committee members have any questions or comments for Senator Dibble? If not, then Senator Dibble will lay Senate File 811 as amended on the table and consider it for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much, Senator Dibble. With that, members, meeting is adjourned.